However, there is a trick. We are not looking just for any type of satisfaction. We are looking for immediate satisfaction. The mismatch between immediate and delayed rewards. Imagine you're an animal roaming the plains of Africa, a giraffe or an elephant or a lion. On any given day, most of your decisions have an immediate impact. You are always thinking about what to eat or where to sleep or how to avoid a predator. You are constantly focused on the present or the very near future. You live in what scientists call an immediate return environment because your actions instantly deliver clear and immediate outcomes. Now, switch back to your human self. In modern society, many of the choices you make today will not benefit you immediately. If you do a good job at work, you'll get a paycheck in a few weeks. If you exercise today, perhaps you won't be overweight next year. If you save money now, maybe you'll have enough for retirement decades from now. You live in what scientists call a delayed return environment because you can work for years before your actions deliver the intended payoff. The human brain did not evolve for life in a delayed return environment. The earliest remains of modern humans, known as Homo sapiens sapiens, are approximately 200,000 years old. These were the first humans to have a brain relatively similar to ours. In particular, the neocortex, the newest part of the brain and the region responsible for higher functions like language, was roughly the same size 200,000 years ago as today. You are walking around with the same hardware as your Paleolithic ancestors. It is only recently, during the last 500 years or so, that society has shifted to a predominantly delayed return environment. Compared to the age of the brain, modern society is brand new. In the last 100 years, we have seen the rise of the car, the airplane, the television, the personal computer, the internet, the smartphone, and Beyoncé. The world has changed much in recent years, but human nature has changed little. Similar to other animals on the African savanna, our ancestors spent their days responding to grave threats, securing the next meal, and taking shelter from a storm. It made sense to place a high value on instant gratification. The distant future was less of a concern. And after thousands of generations in an immediate return environment, our brains evolved to prefer quick payoffs to long-term ones. Behavioral economists refer to this tendency as time inconsistency. That is, the way your brain evaluates rewards is inconsistent across time. You value the present more than the future. Usually, this tendency serves us well. A reward that is certain right now is typically worth more than one that is merely possible in the future. But occasionally, our bias toward instant gratification causes problems. Why would someone smoke if they know it increases the risk of lung cancer? Why would someone overeat if they know it increases their risk of obesity? Why would someone have unsafe sex if they know it can result in sexually transmitted disease? Once you understand how the brain prioritizes rewards, the answers become clear. The consequences of bad habits are delayed, while the rewards are immediate. Smoking might kill you in 10 years, but it reduces stress and eases your nicotine cravings now. Overeating is harmful in the long run, but appetizing in the moment. Sex, safe or not, provides pleasure right away. Disease and infection won't show up for days or weeks, even years. Every habit produces multiple outcomes across time. Unfortunately, these outcomes are often misaligned. With our bad habits, the immediate outcome usually feels good, but the ultimate outcome feels bad. With good habits, it is the reverse. The immediate outcome is unenjoyable, but the ultimate outcome feels good. The French economist Frédéric Bastiat explained the problem clearly when he wrote, "It almost always happens that when the immediate consequence is favorable, the later consequences are disastrous, and vice versa. Often, the sweeter the first fruit of a habit, the more bitter are its later fruits." Put another way, the cost of your good habits are in the present. The cost of your bad habits are in the future. The brain's tendency to prioritize the present moment means you can't rely on good intentions. When you make a plan to lose weight, write a book, or learn a language, you are actually making plans for your future self. And when you envision what you want your life to be like, it is easy to see the value in taking actions with long-term benefits. We all want better lives for our future selves. However, when the moment of decision arrives, instant gratification usually wins. You are no longer making a choice for future you, who dreams of being fitter or wealthier or happier. You are choosing for present you, who wants to be full or pampered or entertained. As a general rule, the more immediate pleasure you get from an action, the more strongly you should question whether it aligns with your long-term goals. This mental setup can derail our decision-making as well. The brain overestimates the danger of anything that seems like an immediate threat, but has almost no likelihood of actually occurring, your plane crashing during a bit of turbulence, a burglar breaking in while you're home alone, a terrorist blowing up the bus you're on. Meanwhile, it underestimates what appears to be a distant threat, but is actually very likely. The steady accumulation of fat from eating unhealthy food, the gradual decay of your muscles from sitting at a desk all day, the slow creep of clutter when you fail to tidy up. With a fuller understanding of what causes our brain to repeat some behaviors and avoid others, let's update the cardinal rule of behavior change. What is immediately rewarded is repeated. What is immediately punished is avoided. Our preference for instant gratification reveals an important truth about success. Because of how we are wired, most people will spend all day chasing quick hits of satisfaction. The road less traveled is the road of delayed gratification. If you're willing to wait for the rewards, you'll face less competition and often get a bigger payoff. As the saying goes, the last mile is always the least crowded. This is precisely what research has shown. People who are better at delaying gratification have higher SAT scores, lower levels of substance abuse, lower likelihood of obesity, better responses to stress, and superior social skills. We've all seen this play out in our own lives. If you delay watching television and get your homework done, you'll generally learn more and get better grades. If you don't buy desserts and chips at the store, you'll often eat healthier food when you get home. At some point, success in nearly every field requires you to ignore the immediate reward in favor of a delayed reward. Here's the problem. Most people know that delaying gratification is the wise approach. They want the benefits of good habits, to be healthy, productive, and at peace, but these outcomes are seldom top of mind at the decisive moment. Thankfully, it's possible to train yourself to delay gratification, but you need to work with the grain of human nature, not against it. The best way to do this is to add a little bit of immediate pleasure to the habits that pay off in the long run, and a little bit of immediate pain to the ones that don't. How to turn instant gratification to your advantage. The vital thing in getting a habit to stick is to feel successful, even if it's in a small way. The feeling of success is a signal that your habit paid off and that the work was worth the effort. In a perfect world, the reward for a good habit is the habit itself. But in the real world, good habits tend to feel worthwhile only after they have provided you with something. Early on, it's all sacrifice. You've gone to the gym a few times, but you're not stronger or fitter or faster, at least not in any noticeable sense. It's only months later, once you shed a few pounds or your arms gain some definition, that it becomes easier to exercise for its own sake. In the beginning, you need a reason to stay on track. This is why immediate rewards are essential. They keep you excited while the delayed rewards accumulate in the background. What we're really talking about here, when we're discussing immediate rewards, is the ending of a behavior. The ending of any experience is vital because we tend to remember it more than the other phases. You want the ending of your habit to be satisfying. The best approach is to use reinforcement, which refers to the process of using an immediate reward to increase the rate of a behavior. Habit stacking, which we covered in Chapter 5, ties your habit to an immediate cue, which makes it obvious when to start. Reinforcement ties your habit to an immediate reward, which makes it satisfying when you finish. Immediate reinforcement can be especially helpful when dealing with habits of avoidance, which are behaviors you want to stop doing. It can be challenging to stick with habits like no frivolous purchases or no alcohol this month, because nothing happens when you skip happy hour drinks or don't buy that pair of shoes. It can be hard to feel satisfied when there is no action in the first place. All you're doing is resisting temptation, and there isn't much satisfying about that. One solution is to turn this situation on its head. You want to find a way to make avoidance visible. Open a savings account and label it for something you want, maybe leather jacket. Whenever you pass on a purchase, put the same amount of money in the account. Skip your morning latte, transfer $5. Pass on another month of Netflix, move $10 over. It's like creating a loyalty program for yourself. The immediate reward of seeing yourself save money toward the leather jacket feels a lot better than just being deprived. You are making it satisfying to do nothing. One of my readers and his wife used a similar setup. They wanted to stop eating out so much and start cooking more together. They labeled their savings account Trip to Europe. Whenever they skipped going out to eat, they transferred $50 into the account. At the end of the year, they put the money toward the vacation. It is worth noting that it is important to select short-term rewards that reinforce your identity rather than ones that conflict with it. Buying a new jacket is fine if you're trying to lose weight or read more books, but it doesn't work if you're trying to budget and save money. Instead, taking a bubble bath or going on a leisurely walk are good examples of rewarding yourself with free time, which aligns with your ultimate goal of more freedom and financial independence. Similarly, if your reward for exercising is eating a bowl of ice cream, then you're casting votes for conflicting identities, and it ends up being a wash. Instead, maybe your reward is a massage, which is both a luxury and a vote toward taking care of your body. Now the short-term reward is aligned with your long-term vision of being a healthy person. Eventually, as intrinsic rewards like a better mood, more energy, and reduced stress kick in, you'll become less concerned with chasing the secondary reward. The identity itself becomes the reinforcer. You do it because it's who you are and it feels good to be you. The more a habit becomes part of your life, the less you need outside encouragement to follow through. Incentives can start a habit. Identity sustains a habit. That said, it takes time for the evidence to accumulate and a new identity to emerge. Immediate reinforcement helps maintain motivation in the short term while you're waiting for the long-term rewards to arrive. In summary, a habit needs to be enjoyable for it to last. Simple bits of reinforcement, like soap that smells great, or toothpaste that has a refreshing mint flavor, or seeing $50 hit your savings account, can offer the immediate pleasure you need to enjoy a habit. And change is easier when it is enjoyable. Chapter summary. The fourth law of behavior change is make it satisfying. We are more likely to repeat a behavior when the experience is satisfying. The human brain evolved to prioritize immediate rewards over delayed rewards. The cardinal rule of behavior change is, what is immediately rewarded is repeated. What is immediately punished is avoided. To get a habit to stick, you need to feel immediately successful, even if it's in a small way. The first three laws of behavior change, make it obvious, make it attractive, and make it easy, increase the odds that a behavior will be performed this time. The fourth law of behavior change, make it satisfying, increases the odds that a behavior will be repeated next time. Chapter 16. How to stick with good habits every day. In 1993, a bank in Abbotsford, Canada, hired a 23-year-old stockbroker named Trent Dersmid. Abbotsford was a relatively small suburb, tucked away in the shadow of nearby Vancouver, where most of the big business deals were being made. Given the location, and the fact that Dersmid was a rookie, nobody expected too much of him. But he made brisk progress, thanks to a simple daily habit. Dersmid began each morning with two jars on his desk. One was filled with 120 paper clips. The other was empty. As soon as he settled in each day, he would make a sales call. Immediately after, he would move one paper clip from the full jar to the empty jar, and the process would begin again. Every morning I would start with 120 paper clips in one jar, and I would keep dialing the phone until I had moved them all to the second jar, he told me. Within 18 months, Dersmid was bringing in $5 million to the firm. By age 24, he was making $75,000 per year, the equivalent of $125,000 today. Not long after, he landed a six-figure job with another company. I like to refer to this technique as the paperclip strategy, and over the years, I've heard from readers who have employed it in a variety of ways. One woman shifted a hairpin from one container to another whenever she wrote a page of her book. Another man moved a marble from one bin to the next after each set of push-ups. Making progress is satisfying, and visual measures, like moving paperclips or hairpins or marbles, provide clear evidence of your progress. As a result, they reinforce your behavior and add a little bit of immediate satisfaction to any activity. Visual measurement comes in many forms: food journals, workout logs, loyalty punch cards, the progress bar on a software download, even the page numbers in a book. But perhaps the best way to measure your progress is with a habit tracker. How to keep your habits on track. A habit tracker is a simple way to measure whether you did a habit. The most basic format is to get a calendar and cross off each day you stick with your routine. For example, if you meditate on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, each of those days gets an X. As time rolls by, the calendar becomes a record of your habit streak. Countless people have tracked their habits, but perhaps the most famous was Benjamin Franklin. Beginning at age 20, Franklin carried a small booklet everywhere he went and used it to track 13 personal virtues. This list included goals like lose no time, be always employed in something useful, and avoid trifling conversation. At the end of each day, Franklin would open his booklet and record his progress. Jerry Seinfeld reportedly uses a habit tracker to stick with his streak of writing jokes. In the documentary Comedian, he explains that his goal is to never break the chain of writing jokes every day. In other words, he is not focused on how good or bad a particular joke is or how inspired he feels. He is simply focused on showing up and adding to his streak. Don't break the chain is a powerful mantra. Don't break the chain of sales calls and you'll build a successful book of business. Don't break the chain of workouts and you'll get fit faster than you'd expect. Don't break the chain of creating every day and you will end up with an impressive portfolio. Habit tracking is powerful because it leverages multiple laws of behavior change. It simultaneously makes a behavior obvious, attractive, and satisfying. Let's break down each one. Benefit number one. Habit tracking is obvious. Recording your last action creates a trigger that can initiate your next one. Habit tracking naturally builds a series of visual cues, like the streak of X's on your calendar or the list of meals in your food log. When you look at the calendar and see your streak, you'll be reminded to act again. Research has shown that people who track their progress on goals like losing weight, quitting smoking, and lowering blood pressure are all more likely to improve than those who don't. One study of more than 1,600 people found that those who kept a daily food log lost twice as much weight as those who did not. The mere act of tracking a behavior can spark the urge to change it. Habit tracking also keeps you honest. Most of us have a distorted view of our own behavior. We think we act better than we do. Measurement offers one way to overcome our blindness to our own behavior and notice what is really going on each day. One glance at the paper clips in the container and you immediately know how much work you have or haven't been putting in. When the evidence is right in front of you, you're less likely to lie to yourself. Benefit number two, habit tracking is attractive. The most effective form of motivation is progress. When we get a signal that we are moving forward, we become more motivated to continue down that path. In this way, habit tracking can have an addictive effect on motivation. Each small win feeds your desire. This can be particularly powerful on a bad day. When you're feeling down, it's easy to forget about all the progress you have already made. Habit tracking provides visual proof of your hard work, a subtle reminder of how far you've come. Plus, the empty square you see each morning can motivate you to get started because you don't want to lose your progress by breaking the streak. Benefit number three, habit tracking is satisfying. This is the most crucial benefit of all. Tracking can become its own form of reward. It is satisfying to cross an item off your to-do list, to complete an entry in your workout log, or to mark an X on the calendar. It feels good to watch your results grow, the size of your investment portfolio, the length of your book manuscript, and if it feels good, then you're more likely to endure. Habit tracking also helps you keep your eye on the ball. You're focused on the process rather than the result. You're not fixated on getting six-pack abs, you're just trying to keep the streak alive and become the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. In summary, habit tracking, one, creates a visual cue that can remind you to act. Two, is inherently motivating because you see the progress you are making and don't want to lose it. And three, feels satisfying whenever you record another successful instance of your habit. Furthermore, habit tracking provides visual proof that you are casting votes for the type of person you wish to become, which is a delightful form of immediate and intrinsic gratification. If you're interested in tracking your own habits, you can find a template to download at atomichabits.com/tracker. Now, you may be wondering, if habit tracking is so useful, why have I waited so long to talk about it? Despite all the benefits, I've left this discussion until now for a simple reason. Many people resist the idea of tracking and measuring. It can feel like a burden because it forces you into two habits, the habit you're trying to build and the habit of tracking it. Counting calories sounds like a hassle when you're already struggling to follow a diet. Writing down every sales call seems tedious when you've got work to do. It feels easier to say, I'll just eat less, or I'll try harder, or I'll remember to do it. People inevitably tell me things like, I have a decision journal, but I wish I used it more, or I recorded my workouts for a week, but then quit. I get it. I've been there myself. I once made a food log to track my calories. I managed to do it for one meal and then gave up. Tracking isn't for everyone, and there's no need to measure your entire life. But nearly anyone can benefit from it in some form, even if it's only temporary. So what can we do to make tracking easier? Well, first, whenever possible, measurement should be automated. You'll probably be surprised by how much you're already tracking without knowing it. Your credit card statement tracks how often you go out to eat. Your Fitbit registers how many steps you take and how long you sleep. Your calendar records how many new places you travel to each year. Once you know where to get the data, add a note to your calendar to review it each week or each month, which is more practical than having to track it every day. Second, manual tracking should be limited to your most important habits. It's better to consistently track one habit than to sporadically track 10. And finally, record each measurement immediately after the habit occurs. The completion of the behavior is the cue to write it down. This approach allows you to combine the habit stacking method mentioned in Chapter 5 with the action of habit tracking. So the habit stacking plus habit tracking formula is: after current habit, I will track my habit. So for example, after I hang up the phone from a sales call, I will move one paperclip over. After I finish each set at the gym, I will record it in my workout journal. After I put my plate in the dishwasher, I will write down what I ate. These tactics can make tracking your habits easier. Even if you aren't the type of person who enjoys recording your behavior, I think you'll find a few weeks of measurements to be insightful. It's always interesting to see how you've actually been spending your time. That said, every habit streak ends at some point, and more important than any single measurement is having a good plan for when your habits slide off track. How to recover quickly when your habits break down. No matter how consistent you are with your habits, it is inevitable that life will interrupt you at some point. Perfection is not possible. Before long, an emergency will pop up. You will get sick, or you have to travel for work, or your family needs a little more of your time. Whenever this happens to me, I try to remind myself of a simple rule: never miss twice. If I miss one day, I try to get back into it as quickly as possible. Missing one workout happens, but I'm not going to miss two in a row. Maybe I'll eat an entire pizza, but I'll follow it up with a healthy meal. I can't be perfect, but I can avoid a second lapse. As soon as one streak ends, I get started on the next one. The first mistake is never the one that ruins you. It's the spiral of repeated mistakes that follows. Missing once is an accident. Missing twice is the start of a new habit. This is a distinguishing feature between winners and losers. Anyone can have a bad performance, a bad workout, or a bad day at work. But when successful people fail, they rebound quickly. The breaking of a habit doesn't matter if the reclaiming of it is fast. I think this principle is so important that I'll stick to it even if I can't do a habit as well or as completely as I would like. Too often, we fall into an all-or-nothing cycle with our habits. The problem is not slipping up. The problem is thinking that if you can't do something perfectly, then you shouldn't do it at all. You don't realize how valuable it is to just show up on your bad or busy days. Lost days hurt you more than successful days help you. If you start with $100, then a 50% gain will take you to $150. But now you only need a 33% loss to take you back down to $100. In other words, a 33% loss is just as meaningful or valuable as achieving a 50% gain. As Charlie Munger says, the first rule of compounding: never interrupt it unnecessarily. This is why bad workouts are often the most important ones. Sluggish days and bad workouts maintain the compound gains you have accrued from previous days. Simply doing something, 10 squats, 5 sprints, a push-up, anything really, is huge. Don't put up a zero. Don't let losses eat into your compounding. Furthermore, it's not always about what happens during the workout. It's about being the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. It's easy to train when you feel good, but it's crucial to show up when you don't feel like it, even if you do less than you hope. Going to the gym for 5 minutes may not improve your physical performance, but it reaffirms your identity. The all-or-nothing cycle of behavior change is just one pitfall that can derail your habits. Another potential danger, especially if you are using a habit tracker, is measuring the wrong thing. Knowing when, and when not, to track a habit. Say you're running a restaurant, and you want to know if your chef is doing a good job. One way to measure success is to track how many customers pay for a meal each day. If more customers come in, the food must be good. If fewer customers come in, something must be wrong. However, this one measurement, daily revenue, only gives a limited picture of what's really going on. Just because someone pays for a meal doesn't mean they enjoy the meal. Even dissatisfied customers are unlikely to dine and dash. In fact, if you're only measuring revenue, the food might be getting worse, but you're making up for it with marketing or discounts or some other method. Instead, it may be more effective to track how many customers finish their meal, or perhaps the percentage of customers who leave a generous tip. The dark side of tracking a particular behavior is that we become driven by the number rather than the purpose behind it. If your success is measured by quarterly earnings, you will optimize sales, revenue, and accounting for quarterly earnings. If your success is measured by a lower number on the scale, you will optimize for a lower number on the scale, even if that means embracing crash diets, juice cleanses, and fat loss pills. The human mind wants to win whatever game is being played. This pitfall is evident in many areas of life. We focus on working long hours instead of getting meaningful work done. We care more about getting 10,000 steps than we do about being healthy. We teach for standardized tests instead of emphasizing learning, curiosity, and critical thinking. In short, we optimize for what we measure, and when we choose the wrong measurement, we get the wrong behavior. This is sometimes referred to as Goodhart's Law. Named after the economist Charles Goodhart, the principle states, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. Measurement is only useful when it guides you and adds context to a larger picture, not when it consumes you. Each number is simply one piece of feedback in the overall system. In our data-driven world, we tend to overvalue numbers and undervalue anything ephemeral, soft, or difficult to quantify. We mistakenly think the factors we can measure are the only factors that exist. But just because you can measure something doesn't mean it's the most important thing. And just because you can't measure something doesn't mean it's not important at all. All of this to say, it's crucial to keep habit tracking in its proper place. It can feel satisfying to record a habit and track your progress, but the measurement is not the only thing that matters. Furthermore, there are many ways to measure progress, and sometimes it helps to shift your focus to something entirely different. This is why non-scale victories can be effective for weight loss. The number on the scale may be stubborn, so if you focus solely on the number, your motivation will sag. But you may notice that your skin looks better, or you wake up earlier, or your sex drive gets a boost. All of these are valid ways to track your improvement. If you're not feeling motivated by the number on the scale, perhaps it's time to focus on a different measurement, one that gives you more signals of progress. No matter how you measure your improvement, habit tracking offers a simple way to make your habits more satisfying. Each measurement provides a little bit of evidence that you're moving in the right direction and a brief moment of immediate pleasure for a job well done. Chapter summary. One of the most satisfying feelings is the feeling of making progress. A habit tracker is a simple way to measure whether you did a habit, like marking an X on a calendar. Habit trackers and other visual forms of measurement can make your habits satisfying by providing clear evidence of your progress. Don't break the chain. Try to keep your habit streak alive. Never miss twice. If you miss one day, try to get back on track as quickly as possible. Just because you can measure something doesn't mean it's the most important thing. Chapter 17. How an accountability partner can change everything. After serving as a pilot in World War II, Roger Fisher attended Harvard Law School and spent 34 years specializing in negotiation and conflict management. He founded the Harvard Negotiation Project and worked with numerous countries and world leaders on peace resolutions, hostage crises, and diplomatic compromises. But it was in the 1970s and 1980s, as the threat of nuclear war escalated, that Fisher developed perhaps his most interesting idea. At the time, Fisher was focused on designing strategies that could prevent nuclear war, and he had noticed a troubling fact. Any sitting president would have access to launch codes that could kill millions of people, but would never actually see anyone die because he would always be thousands of miles away. "My suggestion was quite simple," he wrote in 1981. "Put that nuclear code number in a little capsule, and then implant that capsule right next to the heart of a volunteer. The volunteer would carry with him a big, heavy butcher knife as he accompanied the president. If ever the president wanted to fire nuclear weapons, the only way he could do so would be for him, first, with his own hands, to kill one human being. The president says, 'George, I'm sorry, but tens of millions must die.' He has to look at someone and realize what death is, what an innocent death is. Blood on the White House carpet. It's reality brought home." When I suggested this to friends in the Pentagon, they said, "My God, that's terrible. Having to kill someone would distort the president's judgment. He might never push the button." Throughout our discussion of the fourth law of behavior change, we have covered the importance of making good habits immediately satisfying. Fisher's proposal is an inversion of the fourth law. Make it immediately unsatisfying. Just as we are more likely to repeat an experience when the ending is satisfying, we are also more likely to avoid an experience when the ending is painful. Pain is an effective teacher. If a failure is painful, it gets fixed. If a failure is relatively painless, it gets ignored. The more immediate and more costly a mistake is, the faster you will learn from it. The threat of a bad review forces a plumber to be good at his job. The possibility of a customer never returning makes restaurants create good food. The cost of cutting the wrong blood vessel makes a surgeon master human anatomy and cut carefully. When the consequences are severe, people learn quickly. The more immediate the pain, the less likely the behavior. If you want to prevent bad habits and eliminate unhealthy behaviors, then adding an instant cost to the action is a great way to reduce their odds. We repeat bad habits because they serve us in some way, and that makes them hard to abandon. The best way I know to overcome this predicament is to increase the speed of the punishment associated with the behavior. There can't be a gap between the action and the consequences. As soon as actions incur an immediate consequence, behavior begins to change. Customers pay their bills on time when they are charged a late fee. Students show up to class when their grade is linked to attendance. We will jump through a lot of hoops to avoid a little bit of immediate pain. There is, of course, a limit to this. If you're going to rely on punishment to change behavior, then the strength of the punishment must match the relative strength of the behavior it is trying to correct. To be productive, the cost of procrastination must be greater than the cost of action. To be healthy, the cost of laziness must be greater than the cost of exercise. Getting fined for smoking in a restaurant or failing to recycle adds consequence to an action, but behavior only shifts if the punishment is painful enough and reliably enforced. In general, the more local, tangible, concrete, and immediate the consequence, the more likely it is to influence individual behavior. The more global, intangible, vague, and delayed the consequence, the less likely it is to influence individual behavior. Thankfully, there is a straightforward way to add an immediate cost to any bad habit. Create a habit contract. The habit contract. The first seatbelt law was passed in New York on December 1, 1984. At the time, just 14% of people in the United States regularly wore a seatbelt, but that was all about to change. Within 5 years, over half of the nation had seatbelt laws. Today, wearing a seatbelt is enforceable by law in 49 of the 50 states. And it's not just the legislation. The number of people wearing seatbelts has changed dramatically as well. In 2016, over 88% of Americans buckled up each time they got in a car. In just over 30 years, there was a complete reversal in the habits of millions of people. Laws and regulations are an example of how government can change our habits by creating a social contract. As a society, we collectively agree to abide by certain rules and then enforce them as a group. Whenever a new piece of legislation impacts behavior, seatbelt laws, banning smoking inside restaurants, mandatory recycling, it is an example of a social contract shaping our habits. The group agrees to act in a certain way, and if you don't follow along, you'll be punished. Just as governments use laws to hold citizens accountable, you can create a habit contract to hold yourself accountable. A habit contract is a verbal or written agreement in which you state your commitment to a particular habit and the punishment that will occur if you don't follow through. Then, you find one or two people to act as your accountability partners and sign off on the contract with you. Brian Harris, an entrepreneur from Nashville, Tennessee, was the first person I saw put this strategy into action. Shortly after the birth of his son, Harris realized he wanted to shed a few pounds. He wrote up a habit contract between himself, his wife, and his personal trainer. The first version read, "Brian's number one objective for Q1 of 2017 is to start eating correctly again so he feels better, looks better, and is able to hit his long-term goal of 200 pounds at 10% body fat." Below that statement, Harris laid out a roadmap for achieving his ideal outcome. Phase 1. Get back to a strict, slow-carb diet in Q1. Phase 2. Start a strict macronutrient tracking program in Q2. Phase 3. Refine and maintain the details of his diet and workout program in Q3. Finally, he wrote out each of the daily habits that would get him to his goal. For example, write down all food that he consumes each day, and weigh himself each day. Then he listed the punishment he would suffer if he failed. For example, if Brian doesn't do these two items, then the following consequence will be enforced. He will have to dress up each workday and each Sunday morning for the rest of the quarter. Dress up is defined as not wearing jeans, t-shirts, hoodies, or shorts. He will also give Joey, his trainer, $200 to use as he sees fit if he misses one day of logging food. Finally, at the bottom of the page, Harris, his wife, and his trainer all signed the contract. My initial reaction was that a contract like this seemed overly formal and unnecessary, especially the signatures. But Harris convinced me that signing the contract was an indication of seriousness. "Anytime I skip this part," he said, "I start slacking almost immediately." 3 months later, after hitting his targets for Q1, Harris upgraded his goals. The consequences escalated too. If he missed his carbohydrate and protein targets, he had to pay his trainer $100. If he failed to weigh himself, he had to give his wife $500 to use as she saw fit. Perhaps most painfully, if he forgot to run sprints, he had to dress up for work every day and wear an Alabama hat the rest of the quarter, the bitter rival of his beloved Auburn team. The strategy worked, with his wife and trainer acting as accountability partners, and with the habit contract clarifying exactly what to do each day, Harris lost the weight. If you'd like to create your own habit contract or see the actual habit contracts used by Brian Harris, you can download a template and view them at atomichabits.com/contract. To make bad habits unsatisfying, your best option is to make them painful in the moment. Creating a habit contract is a straightforward way to do exactly that. Even if you don't want to create a full-blown habit contract, simply having an accountability partner is useful. The comedian, Margaret Cho, writes a joke or song every day. She does this song-a-day challenge with a friend, which helps them both stay accountable. Knowing that someone is watching can be a powerful motivator. You are less likely to procrastinate or give up because there is an immediate cost. If you don't follow through, perhaps they'll see you as untrustworthy or lazy. Suddenly, you are not only failing to uphold your promises to yourself, but also failing to uphold your promises to others. You can even automate this process. Thomas Frank, an entrepreneur in Boulder, Colorado, wakes up at 5:55 each morning. And if he doesn't, he has a tweet automatically scheduled that says, "It's 6:10 and I'm not up because I'm lazy. Reply to this for $5 via PayPal, limit 5, assuming my alarm didn't malfunction." We are always trying to present our best selves to the world. We comb our hair and brush our teeth and dress ourselves carefully because we know these habits are likely to get a positive reaction. We want to get good grades and graduate from top schools to impress potential employers and mates and our friends and family. We care about the opinions of those around us because it helps if others like us. This is precisely why getting an accountability partner or signing a habit contract can work so well. Chapter summary. The inversion of the fourth law of behavior change is make it unsatisfying. We are less likely to repeat a bad habit if it is painful or unsatisfying. An accountability partner can create an immediate cost to inaction. We care deeply about what others think of us, and we do not want others to have a lesser opinion of us. A habit contract can be used to add a social cost to any behavior. It makes the costs of violating your promises public and painful. Knowing that someone else is watching you can be a powerful motivator. As we wrap up the fourth law of behavior change, allow me to summarize the different applications we have gone over so far. How to create a good habit. The fourth law is make it satisfying. Application 4.1. Use reinforcement. Give yourself an immediate reward when you complete your habit. Application 4.2. Make doing nothing enjoyable. When avoiding a bad habit, design a way to see the benefits. Application 4.3. Use a habit tracker. Keep track of your habit streak and don't break the chain. Application 4.4. Never miss twice. When you forget to do a habit, make sure you get back on track immediately. And now, how to break a bad habit. The inversion of the fourth law of behavior change. Make it unsatisfying. Application 4.5. Get an accountability partner. Ask someone to watch your behavior. Application 4.6. Create a habit contract. Make the costs of your bad habits public and painful. To see a final version of the cheat sheets for how to create a good habit and how to break a bad habit, please visit atomichabits.com/cheat sheet. Advanced Tactics: How to Go from Being Merely Good to Being Truly Great. Chapter 18: The Truth About Talent. When Genes Matter and When They Don't. Many people are familiar with Michael Phelps, who is widely considered to be one of the greatest athletes in history. Phelps has won more Olympic medals not only than any swimmer, but also more than any Olympian in any sport. Fewer people know the name Hicham El-Guerrouj, but he was a fantastic athlete in his own right. El-Guerrouj is a Moroccan runner who holds 2 Olympic gold medals and is one of the greatest middle distance runners of all time. For many years, he held the world record in the mile, 1500 meter, and 2000 meter races. At the Olympic Games in Athens, Greece in 2004, he won gold in the 1500 meter and 5000 meter races. These two athletes are wildly different in many ways. For starters, one competed on land while the other in water. But most notably, they differ significantly in height. El-Guerrouj is 5 feet 9 inches tall. Phelps is 6 feet 4 inches tall. Despite this 7-inch difference in height, the two men are identical in one respect. Michael Phelps and Hicham El-Guerrouj wear the same length inseam on their pants. How is this possible? Phelps has relatively short legs for his height and a very long torso, the perfect build for swimming. El-Guerrouj has incredibly long legs and a short upper body, an ideal frame for distance running. Now, imagine if these world-class athletes were to switch sports. Given his remarkable athleticism, could Michael Phelps become an Olympic-caliber distance runner with enough training? It's unlikely. At peak fitness, Phelps weighed 194 pounds, which is 40% heavier than El-Guerrouj, who competed at an ultralight 138 pounds. Taller runners are heavier runners, and every extra pound is a curse when it comes to distance running. Against elite competition, Phelps would be doomed from the start. Similarly, El-Guerrouj might be one of the best runners in history, but it's doubtful he would ever qualify for the Olympics as a swimmer. Since 1976, the average height of Olympic gold medalists in the men's 1500-meter run is 5 feet 10 inches. In comparison, the average height of Olympic gold medalists in the men's 100-meter freestyle swim is 6 feet 4 inches. Swimmers tend to be tall and have long backs and arms, which are ideal for pulling through the water. El-Guerrouj would be at a severe disadvantage before he ever touched the pool. The secret to maximizing your odds of success is to choose the right field of competition. This is just as true with habit change as it is with sports and business. Habits are easier to perform and more satisfying to stick with when they align with your natural inclinations and abilities. Like Michael Phelps in the pool or Hicham El-Guerrouj on the track, you want to play a game where the odds are in your favor. Embracing this strategy requires the acceptance of the simple truth that people are born with different abilities. Some people don't like to discuss this fact. On the surface, your genes seem fixed, and it's no fun to talk about things you cannot control. Plus, phrases like biological determinism make it sound like certain individuals are destined for success and others are doomed to failure. But this is a short-sighted view of the influence of genes on behavior. The strength of genetics is also their weakness. Genes cannot be easily changed, which means they provide a powerful advantage in favorable circumstances and a serious disadvantage in unfavorable circumstances. If you want to dunk a basketball, being 7 feet tall is very useful. If you want to perform a gymnastics routine, being 7 feet tall is a great hindrance. Our environment determines the suitability of our genes and the utility of our natural talents. When our environment changes, so do the qualities that determine success. This is true not just for physical characteristics, but for mental ones as well. I'm smart if you ask me about habits and human behavior, not so much when it comes to knitting, rocket propulsion, or guitar chords. Competence is highly dependent on context. The people at the top of any competitive field are not only well-trained, they are also well-suited to the task. And this is why, if you want to be truly great, selecting the right place to focus is crucial. In short, genes do not determine your destiny. They determine your areas of opportunity. As the physician Gabor Mate notes, genes can predispose, but they don't predetermine. The areas where you are genetically predisposed to success are the areas where habits are more likely to be satisfying. The key is to direct your effort toward areas that both excite you and match your natural skills, to align your ambition with your ability. The obvious question is, how do I figure out where the odds are in my favor? How do I identify the opportunities and habits that are right for me? The first place we will look for an answer is by understanding your personality. How your personality influences your habits. Your genes are operating beneath the surface of every habit. Indeed, beneath the surface of every behavior. Genes have been shown to influence everything from the number of hours you spend watching television, to your likelihood to marry or divorce, to your tendency to get addicted to drugs, alcohol, or nicotine. There's a strong genetic component to how obedient or rebellious you are when facing authority, how vulnerable or resistant you are to stressful events, how proactive or reactive you tend to be, and even how captivated or bored you feel during sensory experiences like attending a concert. As Robert Plomin, a behavioral geneticist at King's College in London, told me, "It is now at the point where we have stopped testing to see if traits have a genetic component because we literally can't find a single one that isn't influenced by our genes." Bundled together, your unique cluster of genetic traits predispose you to a particular personality. Your personality is the set of characteristics that is consistent from situation to situation. The most proven scientific analysis of personality traits is known as the Big Five, which breaks them down into five spectrums of behavior. 1. Openness to experience, from curious and inventive on one side of the spectrum to cautious and consistent on the other. 2. Conscientiousness, organized and efficient on one side to easygoing and spontaneous on the other. 3. Extroversion, outgoing and energetic to solitary and reserved. You likely know them as extroverts versus introverts. 4. Agreeableness, friendly and compassionate on one side to challenging and detached on the other. And 5, neuroticism, anxious and sensitive on one end of the spectrum to confident, calm, and stable on the other. All five characteristics have biological underpinnings. Extroversion, for instance, can be tracked from birth. If scientists play a loud noise in the nursing ward, some babies will turn toward it while others turn away. When the researchers tracked these children through life, they found that the babies who turned toward the noise were more likely to grow up to be extroverts. Those who turned away were more likely to become introverts. People who are high in agreeableness are kind, considerate, and warm. They also tend to have higher natural oxytocin levels, a hormone that plays an important role in social bonding, increases feelings of trust, and can act as a natural antidepressant. You can easily imagine how someone with more oxytocin might be inclined to build habits like writing thank you notes or organizing social events. As a third example, consider neuroticism, which is a personality trait all people possess to various degrees. People who are high in neuroticism tend to be anxious and worry more than others. This trait has been linked to hypersensitivity of the amygdala, the portion of the brain responsible for noticing threats. In other words, people who are more sensitive to negative cues in their environment are more likely to score high in neuroticism. Now, our habits are not solely determined by our personalities, but there is no doubt that our genes nudge us in a certain direction. Our deeply rooted preferences make certain behaviors easier for some people than for others. You don't have to apologize for these differences or feel guilty about them, but you do have to work with them. A person who scores lower on conscientiousness, for example, will be less likely to be orderly by nature and may need to rely more heavily on environment design to stick with good habits. As a reminder for the less conscientious readers among us, environment design is a strategy we discussed in chapters 6 and 12. The takeaway is that you should build habits that work for your personality. If you're interested in taking a personality test, you can find links to the most reliable tests at atomichabits.com/personality. People can get ripped working out like a bodybuilder, but if you prefer rock climbing or cycling or rowing, then shape your exercise habits around your interests. If your friend follows a low-carb diet, but you find that low-fat works for you. If your friend follows a low-carb diet, but you find that low-fat works for you, then more power to you. If you want to read more, don't be embarrassed if you prefer steamy romance novels over nonfiction. Read whatever fascinates you. You don't have to build the habits everyone tells you to build. Choose the habit that best suits you, not the one that is most popular. There is a version of every habit that can bring you joy and satisfaction. Find it. Habits need to be enjoyable if they are going to stick. This is the core idea behind the fourth law. Tailoring your habits to your personality is a good start, but this is not the end of the story. Let's turn our attention to finding and designing situations where you are at a natural advantage. How to find a game where the odds are in your favor. Learning to play a game where the odds are in your favor is critical for maintaining motivation and feeling successful. In theory, you can enjoy almost anything. In practice, you are more likely to enjoy the things that come easily to you. People who are talented in a particular area tend to be more competent at that task and are then praised for doing a good job. They stay energized because they are making progress where others have failed, and because they are rewarded with better pay and bigger opportunities, which not only makes them happier, but also propels them to produce even higher quality work. It is a virtuous cycle. Pick the right habit and progress is easy. Pick the wrong habit and life is a struggle. How do you pick the right habit? The first step is something we covered in the third law, make it easy. In many cases, when people pick the wrong habit, it simply means they picked a habit that was too difficult. When a habit is easy, you are more likely to be successful. When you are successful, you are more likely to feel satisfied. However, there is another level to consider. In the long run, if you continue to advance and improve, any area can become challenging. At some point, you need to make sure you're playing the right game for your skill set. How do you figure that out? The most common approach is trial and error. Of course, there's a problem with this strategy, which is life is short. You don't have time to try every career, date every eligible bachelor, or play every musical instrument. Thankfully, there is an effective way to manage this conundrum, and it is known as the explore-exploit trade-off. In the beginning of a new activity, there should be a period of exploration. In relationships, it's called dating. In college, it's called the liberal arts. In business, it's called split testing. The goal is to try out many possibilities, research a broad range of ideas, and cast a wide net. After this initial period of exploration, shift your focus to the best solution you have found, but keep experimenting occasionally. The proper balance depends on whether you're winning or losing. If you are currently winning, you should exploit, exploit, exploit. If you are currently losing, you should explore, explore, explore. In the long run, it is probably most effective to work on the strategy that seems to deliver the best results about 80 to 90% of the time, and keep exploring with the remaining 10 to 20%. Google famously asks employees to spend 80% of the workweek on their official job and 20% on projects of their choice, which has led to the creation of blockbuster products like AdWords and Gmail. The optimal approach also depends on how much time you have. If you have a lot of time, like someone at the beginning of their career, it makes more sense to explore because once you've found the right thing, you still have a good amount of time left to exploit it. If you're pressed for time, say, as you come up on the deadline for a project, you should implement the best solution you've found so far and get some results. As you explore different options, there are a series of questions you can ask yourself to continually narrow in on the habits and areas that will be most satisfying to you. For example, what feels like fun to me, but work to others? The mark of whether you are made for a task is not whether you love it, but whether you can handle the pain of the task easier than most people. When are you enjoying yourself while other people are complaining? The work that hurts you less than it hurts others is the work you are made to do. What makes me lose track of time? Flow is the mental state you enter when you are so focused on the task at hand that the rest of the world fades away. This blend of happiness and peak performance is what athletes and performers experience when they are in the zone. It is nearly impossible to experience a flow state and not find the task satisfying, at least to some degree. Where do I get greater returns than the average person? We are continually comparing ourselves to those around us, and a behavior is more likely to be satisfying when the comparison is in our favor. When I started writing at jamesclear.com, my email list grew very quickly. I wasn't quite sure what I was doing well, but I knew that results seemed to be coming faster for me than for some of my colleagues, which motivated me to keep writing. What comes naturally to me? For just a moment, ignore what you have been taught, ignore what society has told you, ignore what others expect of you. Look inside yourself and ask, what feels natural to me? When have I felt alive? When have I felt like the real me? No internal judgments or people-pleasing, no second-guessing or self-criticism, just feelings of engagement and enjoyment. Whenever you feel authentic and genuine, you are headed in the right direction. To be honest, some of this process is just luck. Michael Phelps and Hikmel Guruje were lucky to be born with a rare set of abilities that are highly valued by society and to be placed in the ideal environment for those abilities. We all have limited time on this planet, and the truly great among us are the ones who not only work hard, but also have the good fortune to be exposed to opportunities that favor them. But what if you don't want to leave it up to luck? If you can't find a game where the odds are stacked in your favor, you can create one. Scott Adams, the cartoonist behind Dilbert, says, "Everyone has at least a few areas in which they could be in the top 25% with some effort. In my case, I can draw better than most people, but I'm hardly an artist. And I'm not any funnier than the average stand-up comedian who never makes it big, but I'm funnier than most people. The magic is that few people can draw well and write jokes. It's the combination of the two that makes what I do so rare. And when you add in my business background, suddenly I had a topic that few cartoonists could hope to understand without living it." When you can't win by being better, you can win by being different. By combining your skills, you reduce the level of competition, which makes it easier to stand out. You can shortcut the need for a genetic advantage, or for years of practice, by rewriting the rules. A good player works hard to win the game everyone else is playing. A great player creates a new game that favors their strengths and avoids their weaknesses. In college, I designed my own major, biomechanics, which was a combination of physics, chemistry, biology, and anatomy. I wasn't smart enough to stand out among the top physics or biology majors, so I created my own game. And because it suited me, I was only taking the courses I was interested in, studying felt like less of a chore. It was also easier to avoid the trap of comparing myself to everyone else. After all, nobody else was taking the same combination of classes, so who could say if they were better or worse? Specialization is a powerful way to overcome the accident of bad genetics. The more you master a specific skill, the harder it becomes for others to compete with you. Many bodybuilders are stronger than the average arm wrestler, but even a massive bodybuilder may lose at arm wrestling because the arm wrestling champ has a very specific strength. Even if you're not the most naturally gifted, you can often win by being the best in a very narrow category. Boiling water will soften a potato but harden an egg. You can't control whether you're a potato or an egg, but you can decide to play a game where it's better to be hard or soft. If you can find a more favorable environment, you can transform the situation from one where the odds are against you to one where the odds are in your favor. How to get the most out of your genes. Our genes do not eliminate the need for hard work. They clarify it. They tell us what to work hard on. Once we realize our strengths, we know where to spend our time and energy. We know which type of opportunities to look for and which type of challenges to avoid. The better we understand our nature, the better our strategy can be. Look, biological differences matter. But even so, it's more productive to focus on whether you are fulfilling your own potential than comparing yourself to someone else. The fact that you have a natural limit to any specific ability has nothing to do with whether you are reaching the ceiling of your capabilities. People get so caught up in the fact that they have limits that they rarely exert the effort required to get close to them. Furthermore, genes can't make you successful if you're not doing the work. Yes, it's possible that the rip trainer at the gym has better genes than you. But if you haven't put in the same reps, it's impossible to say if you've been dealt a better or worse genetic hand. Until you work as hard as those you admire, don't explain away their success as luck. In summary, one of the best ways to ensure your habits remain satisfying over the long run is to pick behaviors that align with your personality and skills. Work hard on the things that come easy. Chapter summary. The secret to maximizing your odds of success is to choose the right field of competition. Pick the right habit and progress is easy. Pick the wrong habit and life is a struggle. Genes cannot be easily changed, which means they provide a powerful advantage in favorable circumstances and a serious disadvantage in unfavorable circumstances. Habits are easier when they align with your natural abilities. Choose the habits that best suit you. Play a game that favors your strengths. If you can't find a game that favors you, create one. Genes do not eliminate the need for hard work. They clarify it. They tell us what to work hard on. Chapter 19. The Goldilocks Rule. How to Stay Motivated in Life and Work. In 1955, Disneyland had just opened in Anaheim, California, when a 10-year-old boy walked in and asked for a job. Labor laws were loose back then, and the boy managed to land a position selling guidebooks for 50 cents apiece. Within a year, he had transitioned